Now, although the story of the Israelites technically begins with the creation story in Genesis, but that story of creation and the story of the first man and woman and the story of the flood and even of the Tower of Babel, many of those stories found in Genesis are also to be found in one form or another in many cultures throughout the world. We could say that they are something of the shared legacy of Lemuria and Atlantis, which are repeated in different ways and different forms in the most important books and scriptures of many cultures. Where do the Israelites really begin? We'd have to say they begin with Abraham. And who was Abraham? Abraham was the son of a very great general of Babylonia. And that general served the ruler of Babylon at that time, who was none other than Gilgamesh. So here is a remarkable sort of great chain of being between Gilgamesh, a worshiper, of course, of many gods and goddesses, but this individual who is indeed that, one of the very first sort of individualities who goes through his existential crisis about life and death and pulls away from the rulership of his land and instead becomes a lonely figure trying to understand who he is and why he's here. But probably before that existential moment in his life, when he was still a great general, serving him, among others, was Abraham's father. So when Abraham leaves the land of his people, not surprisingly, he takes with him their images. He takes the images of the gods. His father, when not fighting, was said to be the greatest idol maker in the land. So Abraham takes those along with him. And only little by little does he start to recognize that the being who is speaking to him, who is leading him, is not of the same rank by any means of the gods whose images and idols were worshipped in Abraham's original native land. Who was this God called Jehovah or Yahweh in the Hebrew scriptures? We've spoken about the hierarchies, of course, and I've taken pains to note that in pre-Christian times, the gods and goddesses were all archai, archangels, and angels, and that most of them were archangels who had the capacity of archai, but it stayed back to be closer to humanity and the earth, and therefore were still of archangelic rank. That many of these angels had archangelic powers, but had stayed back. So these were retarded, hindering beings, but they were spiritual beings and still had capacities and powers and wisdom far exceeding that of human beings. So they were gods. They were their leaders. They were their guides through earthly incarnation and through the beginnings of earthly history. And there was, however, one exception to this, and that was the Israelites. Because in order to counterbalance the rigidification of the earth that was now proceeding rapidly and inexorably, the hierarchies, the highest spiritual beings, had to enlist the help of one of the hierarchical levels that had not been involved in earthly life for a long, long period of time. And they enlisted the help of the spirits of form. That is to say, the spirits even higher than the archai. And they enlisted the help of spirits of form who were not retarded beings, but rather were in the rank in which they belonged. What had the spirits of form done the last time they were involved with the earth? They had worked on the formation and the fixing of the earth's form. I mentioned that the spirits of movement sort of threw up the molten rock in the air, and the spirits of form danced on it, and the mountains then quickly coalesced and came into being. So here were beings who knew all about form, densification, and fixity, and now it was going to be their responsibility to intervene in earthly life for the first time since those long formative periods before, to help to work with an earth that was getting too fixed and too formed. So here we're a class of beings, and we could say that Yahweh is a being, but as it is in the spiritual world, one being or a million beings can be exactly the same thing. So I will use the term Yahweh singular and plural. This is also why at the beginning of the Old Testament, one hears about the Elohim, which is the Hebrew name for the spirits of form, or this particular class, also known as exousiai in Greek. So the spirit of form was called in to intervene in human life and to, as it were, choose a group of people, starting with a small number of people, like the soul looking 500 years in advance at one couple in order to form a genealogical line for itself. This being from the spirits of form was to choose a people who could begin to form something akin to a new race, or at least a very large new group. And this would be a group that would have its luciferic influences expunged, cleaned out of it, so that it could start on a kind of clean sheet and help become a counterbalancing force for the rigidification, and we might say the demonization, of the whole earth sphere. So one could not work with the class of beings that we had before. As Einstein has said, you know, you can't solve the problem with the same kind of thought that created it, and you can't solve the densification of the earth with the same beings that are making it happen. You need intervention from on high, from a higher realm. So this is something very remarkable. However, we have to remember something very important here. Angels, archangels, and even to some degree archai, they all had a memory of what it was like to be in a physical body. They all had a connection with at least the first three stages of Earth evolution. The angels, as we've said, are most empathetic because they're the closest to us. So these three classes, the beings of the third hierarchy, they had a connection to what it was to be a human being, even if you were a man going through that human stage. The hierarchical groupings above them did not. Even Steiner could not describe what it was like when and if a spirit of form had gone through a human stage. It was beyond his provenance. He could not see that. So these were beings who had essentially no interest in human beings as such. Angels are deeply interested in individual human beings. Archangels, very interested in groupings of human beings. Archai are very interested in the history of humanity over long periods of time. And spirits of form, They're interested, in a way, in the engineering, in the plumbing, in the buildings and grounds side of things, volcanoes, earthquakes, the opening up of great seas and the closing of them, the great storms that arise that can bring landslides destroying millions of acres in a few minutes, and so on and so forth. These are beings who have little interest in history and no interest in groups, and certainly not single individuals. So here is a being who's never done this before, who's never had to deal with a single human being, not even a whole group, not even a dynasty. He is being put, this spiritual being, powerful and developed though he is being placed in, we might say, a situation completely foreign to him, for which he has no prior experience. This is the kind of triage, this is the kind of emergency room situation the Earth is in. Although we might say, on the other hand, all of this was carefully planned out at the very beginning, way before Saturn, that things would come to this pass and this hierarchy would have to come to the aid of humanity. So here we have a lofty spirit who has never spoken to a human being before, and now he must speak to Abraham on a regular basis, and speak to Isaac, and speak to Jacob. But we see, as the Israelites develop, their clairvoyance lessens as well, and their direct connection with the spiritual being Yahweh also starts to lessen. So we could say that the patriarchs, those individuals I've just named, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, who's already in a way leaving the pure patriarchal consciousness, and we might say Moses is the last of the patriarchs, they can hear God and they can see God. The next group, who we could call the priests, starting with Moses' brother Aaron and extending through such ne'er-do-wells as Samson, and finally, up to Samuel, they can only hear God. They can't see him. And Samuel, in fact, when he hears God calling him, doesn't even realize it's God. Takes three tries on the part of God to be able to communicate with him. And then finally, we have the kings, who, in a much later stage of the history of the Israelites, and now we're coming to beings who were almost contemporaneous with the first Greeks. So we have kind of this epic, almost tragic period to some extent among the kings. The kings could neither see God nor hear God. Only in their sleep, as with the Psalms of David, could they learn the wisdom of God. Or in Solomon's wonderful Ecclesiastes, the poems, the priestly poems, as it were, that God's word could be made manifest in an artistic way, but not in a direct connection. And then finally, we have the prophets. The prophets who are, again, contemporaneous with the historical Greeks, many of them are. It's very possible, in fact, that Pythagoras met Ezekiel when he was in captivity in Babylon. So here we are back to Babylon again. The priests cannot hear God. The prophets, rather, cannot hear God. They cannot see God. And in fact, some of them even begin to doubt the existence of God. So this is the degree of freedom that the Israelites are given. Their story is, in a way, a microcosmic form of the story of all humanity from the very earliest ages right up to the modern time. Those prophets certainly prefigure the modern world and have been the subject of great interest among many modern poets and writers because of this quality of not knowing if God is there or not. But nonetheless, through most of their history, Yahweh accompanies the Israelites in one way, shape, or form. And we see again and again when there's a kind of duel between one of the prophets and the priests of one of the many pagan religions surrounding the Israelites, how again and again Yahweh always wins. Why, for the most part, the Israelites are able to be victorious on the battlefield again and again because of Yahweh. We have to remember that the Israelites never went beyond the Bronze Age. They never fought with swords and shields that were any harder than bronze, whereas people around them, like the Philistines, whom the Israelites feared completely, the Philistines were already iron workers. So when you go out on the battlefield and your shields and swords are bronze, and your enemy's shields and swords are iron, it's kind of a mismatch. You're not going to win the battle with the Philistines unless there is literally divine intervention. So Yahweh's able to do this. And how does he speak? He speaks in tongues of fire. When Moses receives the tablets from him, he goes up to a mountaintop, which is volcanic in nature. And Emil Bach, the priest of the Christian community, who's written anthropologically and geologically and so on about the stories of the ancient Hebrew scriptures, he describes the volcanic eruptions, the activity that was going on during the time that the Israelites walked the earth and wandered about. So there's always this geological aspect of it. And how are the commandments first revealed? They are inscribed in stone. Now, how do you write something in stone so quickly? Moses wasn't up there carving away, but the being of Yahweh is able to work in stone. He is able to penetrate the world of the dense mineral nature of the earth, and he's able to, as it were, return it to the Lemurian state if need be. So this was the level of being who separated out the Israelites. And what are some of the things that he prohibited? Number one, thou shalt make no graven image of thy God. That is definitely not Luciferic in nature. Very clear. Lucifer would simply have vaporized if he hadn't had all of those images forever being created, reflecting his many faces back to him. That's the first thing that Yahweh prohibits, that now we are to meet a God who, for all practical purposes, is faceless and invisible, because he is of such a high level that we would not, with ordinary earthly eyes, without the very greatest powers of clairvoyance or initiation power, to be able to look upon him. We would be blinded. So, no, his graven image cannot be made. He's much too high and lofty to simply be captured in the stuff of earthly materiality. And also that this is a God who is going to lead his people away from intermarrying with other peoples. That this was very, very important, that a new kind of bloodline was going to be created. And here again, we see this whole kind of specter and this idea of a kind of racism that comes back again, that these other peoples have all been corrupted, that their blood has gotten mixed up with the substantiality of earth. It's Luciferic in nature, or even demonic in nature in a way. and this must be expunged from the Israelites. And so they spend generation after generation removing themselves from the ancient cultures. In Abraham's time, it's removing themselves from the influence of Babylonia. By the time of Moses, it's leaving the land of Egypt. In each situation, the leaders of the Israelites had undergone something of an initiation in one or another of those cultures. So Abraham was definitely bringing knowledge and understanding from Babylonia. Moses, who had been a prince of Egypt, was definitely an Egyptian initiate and very likely initiated in other ways in his younger years as well. But now he cannot lead the Israelites into the promised land. He can only look towards it, but he is himself too much a part of the substance of ancient Egypt. And so the Israelites move forward through the theocratic, monarchical, and finally, we might say, modern path of the prophets, separated from other people. And here Steiner says one of his, again, more controversial statements, that the entire reason, that the entire story of the Israelites boils down to one task only, that they are to be the people whose bloodline is so pure, whose bodily forces, honed by a spirit of form no less, working from very high realms of the spirit, whose bodily forces would be capable of bringing forth physical bodies that could incorporate the being of the Christ. So on the earthly level, here's the stream moving on the horizontal level of the earth, literally traveling across northern Africa, back and forth and hither and thither, until finally finding itself at physically one of the deepest spots of earth, one of the densest points of gravity in the River Jordan area, so that at one point they can provide the physical foundation for the very highest forces to come into the earth and to begin the balancing activity, overcoming the Luciferic forces and preparing the earth to be strong enough to meet the next step, the coming in of Ahrimonic forces in the future.